I'm Chris Boyd. Up next on Think, the complex emotional lives of animals and the clues they give to why we feel and act like we do. We'll spend this hour with primatologist Franz de Waal, who reminds us that emotions are biological functions, the brain's adaptive response to a wide range of situations. We'll talk about how scientists study emotions in subjects that can't talk about how they're feeling, and we'll learn about the complicated evolutionary origins of the smile. Our conversation starts after a short break. Saw that video that went viral about 3 years ago. It was taken when a 59-year-old chimp named Mama was lying close to death in a Dutch zoo.
Mama.
She stopped eating and drinking. She was weak and listless and curled up in the fetal position, motionless except for the slow blinking of her eyes every few seconds. But then an old friend stops by, behavioral scientist Jan van Hoof, who had studied Mama and her colony for decades. The video is really remarkable. When Mama recognizes Van Hoof, she rallies, gives him what looks like a grin, stretches out her arm to gently stroke his cheek and his head as he does the same to her.
Mama?
Yeah.
Van Hoof had come to say goodbye, and it seems that Mama was touched by his kindness and wanted him to know how special he was to her. From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. Since animals have surprisingly similar brain chemistry, it's not such a leap to assume many of their behaviors are driven by their mental state. And my guest believes that while nobody can know exactly what animals feel, it is possible to observe their capacity for love, anger, joy, even empathy. Franz de Waal is C.H. Candler Professor in Emory University's Psychology Department and Director of the Living Links Center at the Yerkes National Primate Research Center. His newest book is called Mama's Last Hug, Animal Emotions and What They Tell Us About Ourselves. Franz, welcome back to Think.
Thank you.
So the video that I described was stunning to a lot of people who saw it who are not experts. Maybe if we'd been watching animals as closely as you have throughout your career, we wouldn't be so surprised.
Yeah, the thing about that video is that it's, of course, very touching. And I was touched since I know Mama. And I know Jan van Hoof also, the professor. But people were very surprised by it. And that is something that surprised me because I thought everyone knows chimpanzees are our closest relatives, which, of course, also means that in every regard in their behavior, they're very like humans also. And so the facial expressions and the gestures that she was using, they reminded people, of course, of what we do. And that is something they shouldn't be surprised about because all the emotions that we have, I think, are present in other species, especially in the other primates. And the facial expressions are very similar. They pout when they're disappointed. They stare at you when they're angry. So the facial expressions are very similar, too.
What can you guess about the origins of the human smile based on your primate observations?
The smile comes probably from many monkeys. They show, they grin, so to speak. They bare their teeth, especially when they're nervous or when they are submissive towards somebody. So it is basically an appeasement display. A dominant individual approaches, and instead of fleeing or crouching, they give them a big grin and this appeases them, and they indicate basically, I'm lower ranking than you. Don't bother with me. I'm not going to do anything against you. So that's the appeasement display. And then later it turned in, for example, chimpanzees, which are not monkeys. In chimpanzees, it turned into a friendly gesture that you can also use under friendly circumstances. So not just when you're afraid or when you're nervous. And in humans, even though we still, if someone smiles too much, we say that person is nervous. But in humans, it has gotten a very friendly component, and so it has retained a lot of that nervousness and appeasement part. So we smile, for example, if we walk into the home of somebody, which is a way of saying, "Well, we are friendly. Don't be afraid of us."
You've even seen primates sort of covering, males covering their grins before there's going to be a confrontation, which is really interesting because not only does it say they understand what it says about them, but they get that another animal seeing them grin will recognize that they're concerned.
Yeah, so the male chimpanzees, when they try to intimidate each other with all their hair up and making themselves look big and strong, if they are confronting the other male and they become nervous about it, they may show a grin face. And so that would indicate to the other male that they are nervous, which is not a good thing if you're trying to intimidate somebody. And so they, most of the time, they just turn around. And so you cannot see the face anymore. So they walk away or they turn around. But sometimes they use their hand to press the lips over their face. So they close their mouth basically manually because they have more control over their hands than their faces, which is something that humans also have. We have much better control over our hands. And so, for example, if, let's say, your child is doing something naughty and you should actually be angry, but you're also amused, you have to hide your smile. And we do that, too. We put a hand over our mouth or maybe a book over our mouth. And so we have more control over our extremities than our face because our face is very closely tied to the emotions, and the emotions are not fully under control.
And it's not just primates. You talk about the expressiveness of horse faces.
Yeah, horses have actually almost as many muscles in the face as the primates do. And so, for example, in the primate literature, for a long time, it was claimed that humans obviously had the most muscles in their face because we have the most shades of emotion and we have the most flexible face. Now, that story doesn't fit because when people analyzed chimpanzee faces, which they did about 5 years ago, they discovered that chimpanzees have exactly the same number of muscles in their face as humans. And so they can also communicate as many shades of emotions as we humans can. And then recently, they looked at the horse family, like zebras, horses, donkeys, and so on. And they found almost as many muscles. And the horses have the advantage over us that they can move their ears. If you have a dog or a cat, you know how expressive that can be, moving your ears around, laying them flat, and things like that. And so the horses have a very wide range of expressions.
Scientists have recently learned that rats display facial expressions.
Yeah, so rats, the story was always that the rodents don't have facial expressions and we made fun of them that they didn't have that, even though there's other species like a dolphin also doesn't have facial expressions. But everyone assumes that dolphins have lots of emotions, but not for the rodents. Until some scientists started working with rodents and noticed that their face changes when they're afraid, for example, of something. And so in one of the experiments, They gave a rat a choice between two photographs. On the one side was a photograph of a relaxed rat, and the other side was a photograph of a rat who had just smelled a cat and was probably afraid. And the rats liked to sit next to the photograph of the relaxed rat. And so they saw the difference in the face, and they prefer a more relaxed individual. And so that whole story that the rodents don't have facial expressions is now gone. And there's also experiments, of course, on the laughter of rats. I don't know if you know those, but rats have ultrasonic vocalization, so you cannot hear them. But Jaak Panksepp, who did these experiments, he started tickling rats. And he found that if you bring the vocalizations, with a machine, you bring the frequency down so that you can hear, you can actually hear those rats laughing. And he also demonstrated that they really like this activity. They follow your hand after you've tickled them. And so rats have also laughter. The laughter of the apes is much more like ours. They have a facial expression, looks very much like the human laugh, and the sounds are within our hearing range, or look like type laughing sounds that they make. And they have the same tickling spots. If you ever tickle a young, let's say, gorilla or chimpanzee, the belly and under the armpits, those are the spots that they really like to be tickled.
How susceptible are other animals to emotional contagion? Like if one rat or chimp or horse is in a bad mood, will another feel the same way?
Yeah, they're very sensitive to this. And so that's the most basic form of empathy, is that you're sensitive to the emotions of others. The more fancy forms of empathy is that you can imagine the situation or you understand the situation. But the most basic one is that someone is afraid and you become afraid, or someone is in a good mood and dancing around and you get into a good mood. That's called emotional contagion, and that is found in all the mammals. It's basically a mammalian characteristic, and it has probably started with maternal care. That's why what we think is that females, whether they're a mouse or an elephant, they need to take care of their offspring. They need to be responsive to the emotions of their offspring. They need to know when they're hungry, when they're cold, and so on. And so for females, this is really survival. Has to do with survival of their offspring. And that's maybe also why empathy is more developed in females than males, which is universal in all the mammals and also in our species. And why oxytocin is involved. Oxytocin is a hormone that is very much involved in lactation and in maternal care. And so that's probably how empathy got started. And then later it spread to other relationships. And so also males can have empathy, clearly. And so it spread to other domains of the society, but it started with the mother-offspring relationship.
You've even seen chimps, mother chimps, adopt infants who needed mothers and learn to bottle feed them because, of course, they weren't lactating.
Yeah, I had a female at the zoo where I worked at the time. Who had lost several offspring, and so she didn't have enough milk for them, and this was all very sad because she would sit in the corner and she would not eat for a couple of weeks, and she would sit in the corner and scream after the loss of her infant, and so it was just a very terrible situation, and we were at the point of maybe sterilizing her, doing something about it, but then in that same period. We got a baby up for adoption, a baby chimpanzee that we could not keep with another female. And so I took up the plan to teach her how to bottle feed that baby. And so I gave her, after 6 weeks, didn't give it right away. I kept the baby for 6 weeks. And in that meantime, I showed her how to bottle feed, and I on occasion let her hold the bottles through the bars, how to bottle feed that baby. And she did very well. She was extremely keen on that baby, very interested in it. And so after 6 weeks, we gave it to her. I put it in the straw of her night cage, and then she didn't want to touch it. She absolutely didn't want to touch it. And this was probably because she considered it my baby.
Hmm.
And in chimpanzees, that's not very well regarded if you, if you without permission, take the baby of somebody else.
Sure.
And so she looked at it. And was really interested, and the caretaker, a woman, and myself, we both kept urging her, telling her, go get it, this is your baby now, and stuff like that. And at some point she picked it up, and she never let it go after that. From that moment on, it was her baby. And then we taught her how to bottle feed, which she did very well. She had obviously learned from seeing me do it. And later she raised her own offspring also that way. And so she her whole life was changed, and that actually that young female that she raised is still in the colony there and has offspring now of her own.
Is there any indication that mother chimps recognize that they're pregnant?
Oh, I think they probably know that. I've seen funny scenes of young individuals walking up to a pregnant female and putting their ear on their belly, which probably indicates that they know that there's something in there. I do think they know these things, especially if they have a long experience. If they have lived in a group like at the Arnhem Zoo where there's 25 chimps, they have seen others pregnant and they have seen birth, and yeah, they know more about it, I think.
You think they think ahead to the existence of a baby in a few months?
Well, they certainly can think ahead. We have all sorts of experiments now that indicate that chimpanzees have planning capacities. Not just chimpanzees. This has also been shown in certain birds and so on. But for example, chimpanzees in the wild, they will collect tools. For example, long grass helms. They will put them in their mouths and walk for miles. And so 2 hours, 3 hours later, they arrive at the termite hills, where they can use them to fish for termites, meaning that they probably for 2 or 3 hours have been planning to go there.
Hmm.
So we have all these indications that they can think ahead. And so why not a pregnant female?
Hmm. My guest is Franz de Waal. He is C.H. Candler Professor in Emory University's Psychology Department and Director of the Living Link Center at the Yerkes National Primate Research Center. His new book is called Mama's Last Hug, Animal Emotions and What They Tell Us About Ourselves. We'll come back to the conversation in 2 minutes. You can join us at 800-933-5372. Listening to Think. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with Franz de Waal, who is C.H. Candler Professor in Emory University's Psychology Department and Director of the Living Link Center at the Yerkes National Primate Research Center. His newest book is Mama's Last Hug, Animal Emotions and What They Tell Us About Ourselves. You can join the conversation by calling 800-933-5372, or you can find us on Twitter at KERATHINK. Franz, one of the things I always look forward to reading your books is that they remind me to sort of pay attention to the world in a different way. Can you talk about what you're looking for as you observe animals and about the things you might notice about the scene and the context that most of us would overlook?
Train in people. I'm a born observer, so I'm very patient. Normally in life, I'm not so patient, but as soon as it comes to animals, I just wait things out, and also actually with humans is, for example, if I go into a restaurant, I like to sit at a table from which I can see lots of other tables, and then I follow all the social scenes that are going on there. So I sort of automatically absorb details of facial expressions and body language and things like that. The language itself that humans use, I'm not particularly interested in. So if, for example, if I look at a political debate, let's say between Clinton and Trump or something, I'm much more interested in the body language. I don't particularly care what they're saying. I'm just looking at what they're doing. So some individuals are very good at observing. I've had many students, of course, in my life. And sometimes students, especially bird watchers, I think they have a sort of natural ability. And that maybe also draws them to bird watching. People who are good at that kind of things, they're usually good observers. And what you need to do is if you observe a group of, let's say, 25 chimps or a group of 100 monkeys, we do that also, you need to be able to both focus on the individuals that are doing something interesting and everything around it. It's a bit like with a sports match. If you look at soccer matches or football matches, You're not only focused on the ball and what people are doing there. You look around it because you need to see the whole pattern and the whole strategy that is going on. And I think if you look at a monkey group, yes, there may be two individuals fighting, and you're looking at that, but you also look at everything around it to understand all the social influences, because clearly two individuals never fight on their own. There's always influence of certain, let's say, the mother or the dominant male or whatever. There's always other influences going on also.
You think that psychologists who want to understand human behavior could learn a lot more if they spent more time observing and less time talking to their subjects?
Yeah, I don't believe in the questionnaire method that the psychologists now use so extensively. I don't trust that one bit or another. People do that. They will ask you, are you a jerk or are you empathic? And I probably choose empathic because I don't want to be a jerk. And now they don't ask it so directly, but they ask you questions about, let's say, your sex life or your food intake or whatever. Let me actually give you a story on food intake. This was a scientist who did studies on pregnancy and food intake by females in monkeys and found that female monkeys, when they're pregnant, they eat five times more than they usually do, which is not really so surprising. He did the same thing on humans, Americans, women who are pregnant, and he found that nothing changed. They kept eating exactly the same thing. And he was so surprised by it that he changed his method. Instead of asking them questions, he said, bring me the grocery receipts, the receipts from the grocery store. Mm-hmm. And that's where he saw all sorts of things that he had not seen before, that these women were buying, apparently, and maybe eating, you would assume. And so that shows already that if you go into the behavior instead of asking questions, you probably get more reliable information. And I'm personally very happy that I work with subjects that cannot talk and cannot fill out questionnaires, because I just have to see what they do.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go on the phone now to Sanjeev in Arlington, Texas. Hi, Sanjeev.
Hi, Chris. We've spoken several times. I'm very much enjoying your conversation with Franz. Thank you very much. But the comment I have, I will try to make it short, which is I think people need to realize these animals that are being discussed arrived on the planet much before we did, and they evolved. And were able to survive. How did they do it? Without language? Just because we don't understand the language, does that mean that the language doesn't exist?
Well, thank you so much for calling. What about that, Franz?
Yeah, so some of these animals arrived very early in the history, but of course chimpanzees and humans, they split only like 5 million years ago. We consider that very shortly ago in biology. So humans and chimps are extremely close. And since that split between us and them, chimps changed, obviously, because they kept going in terms of adapting to the environment. And we changed. We changed more dramatically, maybe, because we became bipedal and we got these huge brains that we got. So yes, all species keep changing to some degree, some more, some less. And they work without language, and chimpanzees have their own communication, of course, going, and dolphins have their own communication, and elephants. Every species has its own communication. And we humans, we have a lot of nonverbal communication, and it's actually very important to us. So we tend to rely on language, but try to reconcile with a colleague over email or by text, it's not going so well usually. You have to walk into their office and look at them face to face, and that's how we do these things. And the reason we have, for example, invented all these emoticons now that we send around with our messages is because we know that just purely text and language is insufficient to communicate with others. And so I always feel that the nonverbal communication is extremely important. Even the tone of your voice, which is also part of your body and your emotions. If you talk with a friend over the phone, you get a much better idea of how they feel about something than when you have an exchange of text messages. So all this nonverbal communication remains important for us.
So we think of our intellect as being important to our survival, our evolutionary survival. We don't necessarily think of our emotions. Can you talk about the biological function of emotions in humans and in other animals?
Yeah, the emotions are awfully important because let's say an emotion like fear, that's maybe the most obvious case. You need to be fearful of certain things like predators. Or disgust, you need to reject certain foods that may be contaminated or poisonous to you. Anger, you need to, if you have a territory as an animal or as a human for that matter, you need to defend your territory. And so all these emotions have their functions. I compare them really with organs. There's in my body, there's not a single organ that you don't find in the body of your dog. Hmm. I have lungs and kidneys and heart and brain. All these organs are basically the same across all the mammals, and they evolved all for a reason. And if you take one of them out, you're going to die. If you take your spleen out or whatever, you're probably not going to survive. And so all of them have their function, and the same is true, I think, for all the emotions. I don't think we have necessarily different or new emotions that are not present in other species. We may use them a bit more sophisticated way or maybe under a wider range of circumstances, but we have basically a basic set of emotions that we share with a lot of other species.
So one reason that animal emotions hadn't been studied carefully until recently is that they're, I guess, hard to measure in a way that can be standardized. Can you talk about some of the ways that you can observe and measure animal emotions when they can't talk to you? And it's a little hard to sort of say for sure, is that joy? Is that love? Mm-hmm. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, so one of the problems with the emotions is that we associate them with feelings, and the feelings, which are private states, are your experiences. the feelings are not really accessible for animals, and I would say for humans they're also very hard to know. It's very hard for me to know what you feel, even if you talk about it to me. So, first of all, we need to separate emotions from feelings. Then, the emotions, they are expressed in the body. So the emotions always affect your body, your heart rate, your blood pressure, your skin conductance. And some of these changes, like also in the face, can easily be measured. I can easily measure the changes in the body, the temperature changes, the heart rate changes, the cortisol levels, which is a stress hormone. So, for example, when animals, if we say animals are stressed, we measure in their urine or in their blood the cortisol level to see if that's really the case. So we have all sorts of ways of measuring the emotions in the same way that we can measure them in humans. And so the story that emotions cannot really be measured is not really correct. So, for example, a rat will get, if you expose a rat to the smell of a cat, they become afraid, obviously. Mm-hmm. Their temperature of their feet and their tail goes down. So it's very similar to humans who will have cold feet. We have that expression, you're getting cold feet, which is that you are afraid of something. And so that's universal in all the mammals. Your temperature of your extremities goes down when you are afraid. And so all these changes can be measured, really.
Humor feels like a really human thing, but there's evidence that other animals at least appreciate pranks. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, pranks. Actually, chimpanzees have been tested on which kind of movies they like to watch. they like to watch slapstick. Now, slapstick is interesting because in slapstick, of course, people fall and they stumble and they get a bucket of water over their head and stuff like that. So that's the sort of thing that chimps think is amusing, I suppose. But yeah, there are many observations, but they are mostly anecdotal, of great apes laughing because they have a laugh expression and they make laughing sounds at moments where we would think something to be funny. So to give an example, we had a colleague at the zoo where I worked who had a panther mask, and he would put that mask on and hide in the bushes, and on the other side of the motor would be 25 chimps, and each time he showed his face coming up out of these bushes, the chimps would get totally mad at him and throw all sorts of stuff at him, so also smelly stuff that was not so pleasant for him. And they were really furious until one moment he stuck up his head, he showed himself, and then he took very slowly, he took the mask off and showed his own human face, which they knew because they knew him.
Mm-hmm.
And there were quite a few chimps who had that laugh expression on their face, which we associate with them usually being in a playful mood. And so it all almost seemed that as if they thought this was an amusing ending. And it's very similar to when we tell a joke. We always say a joke has a punchline. The punchline is an unexpected ending of the story. And so we think that is amusing. And another situation where chimpanzees show their laugh expression is, for example, when the most dominant male, the alpha male, he has scared a baby, a little baby chimp, and the baby screams and yells at him and goes after him, and he escapes, he walks away from the baby. But he may have that very big laugh expression on his face as if he thinks it's really amusing that he's being chased by this little baby. So that kind of situations does occur, and I would not rule out that that the sense of humor is not limited to our species.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. All right, let's go back to the phones now. Our number is 1-800-933-5372. Paula is calling us from Austin. Hi, Paula.
Hi there. I wanted to ask your guest what he thinks about the policy of taking retired research chimps and relocating them to sanctuaries and removing them from their tribe that they've lived with for their whole life. I know here outside of Austin in Bastrop, we have an MD Anderson Research Institute, and when they relocated 13 of their chimps, 9 of them died within a year and a half. So I'm wondering about the stress and the taking them away from their family and how that impacts them.
Thanks for calling.
Yeah, I'm involved with Chimp Haven, which is where many of the chimps go. I've been on the board of Chimp Haven for a long time, where we now have more than 200 chimpanzees that come from research settings. Usually when we move animals to Chimp Haven, these are chimps who are not under very good circumstances, or we move an entire family, so we don't move just one chimp, but 10 of them or something. So I think we try to take that into account. And I know the Bastrop facility is actually an excellent facility, and I think there's less need of moving those chimps probably than some other chimps that I know. So yes, and these things may happen. These are usually aging animals, and so it is unpredictable what will happen if we move them. And sometimes they die of perfectly natural causes, and they would have died in the home institution just as well. So that is sometimes hard to judge. But we are in the process because biomedical research on chimpanzees has mostly stopped. It has mostly disappeared now. And so we are in the process of moving many chimps to Chimp Haven and giving them a better home, because they have beautiful islands there, 1, 2, 3 acre islands, forested islands. That's where the chimpanzees live. And so it's a very good facility, Chimp Haven. But sometimes it happens that animals die when they arrive, or within a year after arrival.
So you're doing behavioral research, is that correct, the work that you do?
Yeah, I do only behavioral research. I don't even do neuroscience on chimpanzees or monkeys. I'm not a neuroscientist. And so I do purely behavioral studies. And for example, with the chimpanzees, they live in a social group. They live outdoors on grass, and they have a climbing structure and all of that. But we call them into a building for the tests that we do. We call them by name, and they will come in maybe for half an hour or an hour, and we expose them to whatever the situation is. We may have a touch screen for them to see if they can recognize faces or how they look at movies and things like that. Or we do tasks where they have to share food. Are they willing to procure food for somebody else? And they're actually perfectly willing to do that, is to work for food that goes to somebody else. And so we do that kind of experiments on cooperation and their understanding of their society.
I thought it was interesting that you said you always try to devise experiments that will be fun for the subject, meaning fun for the chimp.
Yeah, I don't want to do it any other way, because also we are dependent on them wanting to come in. We cannot force them into a test that they have no desire to do. So we have to lure them in. We have food, of course. We have air conditioning, which is also important. So we try to make it as pleasant and fun as we can to get them in.
My guest is Frans de Waal. He is C.H. Candler Professor in Emory University's Psychology Department, directs the Living Links Center at the Yerkes National Primate Research Center, and he has a new book on shelves. It's called Mama's Last Hug, Animal Emotions and What They Tell Us About Ourselves. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372. This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with Frans de Waal, who is professor in Emory University's Psychology Department, directs the Living Links Center at the Yerkes National Primate Research Center, and is author of a new book called Mama's Last Hug, Animal Emotions and What They Tell Us About Ourselves. You can join us via Twitter. We are at KERATHINK. You mentioned disgust before, Frans, and that's one of those emotions that I think even non-scientists can understand would have a biological basis, right? We're disgusted by things that might be bad for us in some cases, also by stuff we just don't care for. And I was really interested to read that chimps have something called rain face that is almost universal. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, so disgust is an interesting emotion because it is considered usually one of the basic emotions, but recently psychologists have elevated it to something special, and they say because we have moral disgust, for example, you may be disgusted by someone who fakes an attack on himself, or by people who get their kids into college with the wrong methods. So you may be disgusted, and that's called moral disgust. And so as a result, psychologists got confused, I think, and they forgot the origin of disgust is a very deep biological origin, which is that you need to reject foods that you don't. And we have a face for that. If you put something in front of me that smells bad, I'm going to pull a certain face. I bring my upper lip closer to my nose, and I also narrow my eyes, which is all intended, that face is actually intended to keep certain substances out of your face. And chimpanzees show that face when it rains, for example. So when it all of a sudden starts to rain, they have a rain face, and it's a disgust face. It looks exactly like the human disgust face, because rain is disgusting to them. They really don't like it. And I know that face very well, because in Holland, where I'm from, people bike a lot, and
right.
and they often bike in the rain, and they're really it's really unpleasant to do that, and I always hate that. And then you have these plastic ponchos, but they don't really help so much.
So you see a lot of rain face, is what you're
yeah,
saying.
That's yeah, that's a very typical face.
You remind us that, you know, some animals that strike us as cruel or scary, like snakes, might kill without any understanding of the effect they're having on another creature. But lots of mammals seem motivated to relieve the distress of a companion. So is there something special about the morality or the understanding of their effect on other people that is unique to mammals or other creatures,
yeah,
excuse me?
Yeah, many animals have consolation, we call it. So they react to the distress of somebody else by consoling them. The first studies of consolation were human studies, where a scientist would ask people in a family to cry, and then they would see how very young children responded. And even kids who could barely walk, they would walk up to this person and touch their face and stroke them, and if they can talk, they would say, how you're doing, and things like that. But in that same study, they already discovered, this is like 50 years ago, they already discovered that the dogs were doing the same thing.
Hmm.
The dogs were licking the face or putting the head in the lap of someone who was crying. And so if that is an empathy response, which it clearly is for children, then we should probably also call it an empathy response for the dog. And we have done a lot of research on consolation behavior in primates. I have also worked on elephants on that. Recently, we did a study on rodents. And basically, all the mammals, they have these responses where they are attracted to someone who's distressed and try to calm them down, put them in their arms or kiss them or whatever the behavior is. But the reason I think people like dogs and call the dog man's best friend is partly because dogs are sensitive to our emotions and react to them.
Elephants can be drama queens?
Elephants. Yeah, there was a situation which was really curious. This was at a zoo in Korea, South Korea, where a baby elephant fell into a pond, and the mother was in panic and was standing on the side and was in panicked because her kid was in the water, and another female came up to her, and instead of walking into the water to save the calf, she pushed that mother in the direction of where she could walk into it, because there was a sort of steps there. And she pushed the mother there, and she ended up guiding her calf out of the water. And it was all totally exaggerated, because baby elephants can swim. So, and they have these snorkels, natural snorkels. And so there was absolutely no reason to be so panicky about it, and it turned out all right. What I found most interesting about that case is that the other female, instead of saving the calf, made the mother save the calf. So there was a certain education in there. And the elephant experts, they told me later that elephants are drama queens, in the sense that there was no need to be so panicky about the whole thing. But they like to do that, to make a whole show out of it.
So lots of people who have dogs are sure that dogs feel guilt, right? Like if you come home and they've torn up a pillow or chewed on a shoe or gotten into some food or something, everybody knows that look that dogs give. What do we know about whether they actually know they've done something that they're going to be in trouble for?
Yeah, so there are experiments that have been done on this by scientists, and basically their conclusion was that what dogs have is anticipation of punishment.
Hmm.
It's not exactly guilt. They know when they're in trouble. You come home, you start scolding your dog because they have chewed up your shoes, and the dog takes that look, which is a way of avoiding further punishment maybe. And so they say the dog may not have felt guilt, but just knew that they were in trouble. Now, there's two things I want to say about that. First of all, I think a lot of human guilt is like that also.
Huh.
Human, human guilt is, you know, when politicians say they regret something, it's very often that they anticipate trouble and they don't really feel so bad about it, but that's what they're going to say in public. So that's one thing. The second thing is that I often hear from dog owners that they come home and they have not noticed anything, but they can see, looking at their dog, that something has happened. So they may have more than one dog, and they can see that one dog has done something wrong. And then later they discover what it is, and they may have pooped behind the couch or whatever it is that they did. And the dog is basically signaling to them in their behavior that they did something. So that's not the same as that they know that they are in trouble or that they are afraid of punishment. I think there's more going on. And so we need more experiments. I think dogs may, to some degree, internalize these things. And so guilt is not completely excluded in their case.
All right, let's go back to the phones. 1-800-933-5372 is our number. Henry is calling from Dallas. Hi, Henry.
Good day, all. So by looking at human ethnographies, ancient myths, it's easy to see that people of any age, any education, any geographical location share certain themes, rites of passage, protecting their turf.
Sure.
And so on. And the turf protection, at least, and the rites of passage, I think, apply to the animal world as well. So I believe that there is an archetypal passing on from not inheritance. I mean, the archetypes have always been there, and animals take them up as well as humans.
Well, maybe you can talk a little bit about patterns of behavior, Franz, that you can see in humans and primates and other mammals as well.
Yeah. The talk about protecting your turf makes me think, of course, of territoriality, which is a very old characteristic. The fish have territories, birds have territories. Lots of animals have certain areas which they defend where their partners live or their offspring live and where they have resources, and they can be very fierce about it. For example, chimpanzees, they may kill over their territory. They kill other males sometimes in order to protect their territory. So there are certain behavioral tendencies that are extremely old. And I think caring for your offspring, and that's not even limited to the mammals, of course. There's lots of other species who do that. And so there are certain tendencies that are very old. And there may be others that are new that are only found in humans, related maybe to our modern societies, like using your cell phone. Those things may be new. But even the cell phone we use to check on Facebook. And what is Facebook? Facebook is basically your social relationships. Hmm. And so in that sense, it's extremely old again.
You're listening to Think. I'm Chris Boyd. So let's go back to Mama, who we talked about at the beginning, this elderly chimp who died. She seems to have been really a fascinating individual, not because she was so different from all other chimps ever, but because she was an individual. Can you tell us a little bit about her and about, it seems like she gained what could be described as a kind of wisdom over the course of her long life?
Yeah, she was the mediator of the group. And so she was, at the end of her life, of course, she was still the dominant female, actually. She could barely walk anymore, but she was so highly respected that she was still the alpha female. But during her life, she would bring the group together. She would, for example, if males had a fight and they could not reconcile, she would step in and bring one male to the other to make sure that they reconciled. And so she also was a sort of representative of the group. So for example, one day we had a young alpha male who was not really very accepted by the group in his position, and he was chased up into a tree by the whole colony and was kept there. He was not allowed to come out, and each time he tried to come down, they chased him back up. And it's only after 15 minutes or so that Mama climbed up that tree very slowly, because he's not a very fast climber. She climbed up very slowly, and she touched him, and she kissed him, and she brought him back. And from that moment on, he was accepted back by the rest. Hmm. So that indicates a bit her very powerful position in the group. I always make a distinction between rank and power. Mama did not rank above the males. The males are physically very dominant in a chimpanzee society. And so she did not rank above them, but she was certainly more powerful than most of the males in the sense that everyone listened to her, not to maybe that young alpha male, for example. So yes, she was a very central figure. And also we now notice that now that she has died a couple of years ago, that the group is quite a bit in turmoil. So she had a very cohesive function, I think, in the group.
One of the things that emotions do for us, one of the functions for humans, is that like traumatic emotions help us to remember things that might have been dangerous so that in the future we can avoid that kind of situation. Is there an indication that emotion plays a role in animal memories?
Well, that is very likely, because we are much better at remembering emotional situations than non-emotional ones. So for example, if you test humans on pictures, like 20 pictures, and you ask them to half an hour later to remember which ones they had seen, the emotional ones are remembered much better than the non-emotional ones, like the ones of cars or houses. They are not remembered so well. And I think the same is probably true for other animals. We now have a lot of research on what is called episodic memory, which means can you remember back to specific events? And they test that in birds and in primates and all sorts of species. And the animals are capable of remembering certain scenes. And I bet that is also just as in humans, it's mediated by what is emotionally relevant to them. So it must be similar.
Your career has focused on mammals, but you write toward the end of the book about just watching these fish that you have and have had for several years.
Yeah, I'm very fond of fish. I've always had fish as a kid. I have an just a small detail. I have an aunt, my godmother, who is now 102 years old.
Wow.
And recently I visited her and she said, yeah, you were always in the mud and always with water. And so she remembered me as doing that. And I'm still having tanks and cleaning them and all of that. I really like that. And the fish are so interesting because fish are sort of underestimated. There was even for a long time people would say fish don't feel pain. Fortunately, that has now stopped. People realize that fish can feel pain. But fish were always underestimated. And fish are such an interesting group because some fish have pair bonds. Some fish care for their young. So fish are very variable. And I'm very happy to work with them.
How can we use the kinds of things that you're learning about animals' experience of emotions to care for animal welfare?
Yeah, I think the sort of work that I do on animal intelligence and animal emotions has moral implications. I think we are not treating a lot of animals very well. So maybe the animals at home we are treating well, but there's lots of animals in the agricultural industry that are not treated so well. And I think we need to change our behavior. Ideally, I would say we eat maybe half of the meat that we eat, so we eat less meat, and the animals that we do eat, we treat a lot better than before, and I think that we have to strive for that kind of situation.
Franz de Waal is C.H. Candler Professor in Emory University's Psychology Department and Director of the Living Links Center at the Yerkes National Primate Research Center. His new book is Mama's Last Hug, Animal Emotions and What They Tell Us About Ourselves. Franz, it's always a pleasure. Thanks again for making time to speak with us.
Thank you. Thank you. You're welcome.
You can follow us on Facebook and Twitter. Our handle is @KERAThink. Use your favorite podcast app to subscribe to the Think podcast or listen to the podcast at our website, think.kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.